Thank you for tuning in to WPDMLP, Asheville, North Carolina, 103.7, streaming online, WPVMFM.org, the voice of Asheville, heard all over the world.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is Ann Oliva. She's the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. It's a public education, advocacy, and capacity building organization dedicated to ending homelessness in the United States. Ann is a career veteran of homelessness and housing policy and is recognized as one of the foremost experts on homelessness in the nation. In her role, Ann works closely with members of Congress and the administration, as well as with officials and advocates at the state and local levels. Her career is also marked by a decade of federal service at the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, and in 2015, Ann was named one of the 50 most influential leaders in the department's first 50 years. Ann Oliva, welcome to A Better World.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to talk with you today.
Thank you. So let's get started. Tell me, how did the National Alliance to End Homelessness get started?
Well, the National Alliance to End Homelessness is an organization just a little over 40 years old, and it was started in a bipartisan effort by a number of prominent folks in Washington, D.C., to address the emerging crisis of homelessness. And for all of its history now, the National Alliance has been bipartisan, an organization really focused on what it will take to end homelessness in this country.
I was intrigued by the values, as stated on your website, about faith, love, and home. And I was wondering if you could talk about those.
Thank you so much for asking that question. So many people don't ask about it. And the values that we have listed on our website are something that we developed as an internal staff and as a board alongside all of our members across the country. I'm pretty new in this position. I've been at the Alliance for about 3.5 years, and I took over from Nan Roman, who had been in the CEO position for about 30 years. So when I came on board, we did a pretty significant review of where we wanted to go as an organization with new leadership. How did we want to address the changes in the environment that we have been seeing over the last 10 years or so? I did a full sort of listening tour across the country. And what kept coming across to us as we were engaging in those conversations with people who are experiencing homelessness across the country, with the providers who serve them, and with our colleagues at the national and local levels, was that folks really wanted us to talk about our values and to tell people exactly what drives us and how we're going to be making decisions. And when you look at those three words, there's actually quite a bit behind it. We want to make sure that we are in a position where we're leading with love, where we're leading with equity, and that we're treating all of our unhoused neighbors with love and compassion And that feels really fundamental to an organization who's trying to end homelessness. We also want to make sure that we are instilling faith that ending homelessness is possible. And I absolutely believe that. And at the end of the day, homelessness doesn't get ended unless we bring people home. And it felt like a really easy way to just be very clear about how we approach our work.
So you mentioned about going around and speaking to partner organizations. What type of organizations does the Alliance collaborate with?
Well, we have members, and our members are all different kinds of organizations and stakeholders who have the same mission as us, which is to end homelessness in the United States or end homelessness in their community. So it could be local organizations that are serving people experiencing homelessness. In a lot of cases, it's nonprofits, but in many cases, it's also local government or state government entities that are serving people experiencing homelessness. We have researchers that work with us all the time that are part of our membership. We have people experiencing homelessness or who have experienced homelessness in their lives are part of our membership. We have faith leaders that are part of our membership. So it's a pretty broad coalition of organizations and people who not only have similar values to us, but have similar mission to us.
How do you define homeless? Is it people that have no shelter at all? Is it people who don't have a home? What's the difference between the chronically homeless and, say, the people that are short-term homeless?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'm going to break it up into sort of three categories, right? You mentioned people who are literally homeless. That is, people who are living in unsheltered locations or living in shelters or other temporary programs or accommodations. All those folks are part of the group of people. When we say people experiencing homelessness, that's what we mean. There is a subset of that. There are many subsets of that because homelessness, people experiencing homelessness are not sort of a monolith, right? We have families with kids. We have veterans. We have young people between the ages of 18 to 24. We have older adults now over the age of 55, which is a growing population. So there's lots of subcategories of what I just talked about. But one of them that you mentioned is people experiencing chronic homelessness. And that has been a focus of ours and the federal governments for quite a number of years, in part because these are the folks that have been homeless for a long time or homeless many times over the course of a number of years. And they often have disabling conditions or disabilities, which means that they need help with sort of the activities of daily living. And they are often folks that people see on the streets. And then the third category that I would point out to you are folks who are at risk of homelessness. And that is a really large number of people in this country, folks who are paying more than 30 or 50% of their income towards rent. They are folks who are right on the margins of our society who, you know, are one paycheck or one, you know, emergency away from losing their housing. And that's another group of people that we pay a lot of attention to.
In North Carolina, they do this, and maybe it's something that happens all across the country. It's called the PIT count, P-I-T, where they take a kind of a count once a year. And the one for 2024 found that there was an increase of 19% over the same count from 2023 in terms of the number of people who are experiencing homelessness. Can you talk about what the state of homelessness is today?
Sure. First, I'll say that the point in time count or the PIT count, as you referred to it, is something that happens all over the country. It is required under the McKinney-Vento Act, which is the law that governs HUD's homelessness programs and homelessness programs and other federal agencies. So communities across the country go out on a single night at the end of January and enumerate the number of people who are experiencing homelessness in their community both in unsheltered locations and in sheltered locations. That data is rolled up into a national report called the Annual Homelessness Assessment Report, Part One, just to be technical about it. And it provides a snapshot from year to year on what's happening, what the trends are in homelessness across the nation. So to answer the second part of your question, since 2016, we've seen an increase in unsheltered homelessness every year since 2016. And that aligns with sort of how the housing market has been in most communities. I know, for example, in Asheville, in your state, housing is really expensive, and the vacancy rate for units that are actually affordable is quite low. So that creates a market dynamic where people are being pushed out of what used to be affordable housing as rents increase and increase and increase, and their incomes don't increase accordingly. So the PIT count is a really important tool for both localities and the federal government to understand what's happening from year to year and to see broad trends. What it's not is the only way that we measure homelessness or try to understand what's happening around homelessness, either in a community or in the nation as a whole. We also look at longitudinal data, which tracks people over time. We also look at data about worst case housing needs or how many people are on the margins or paying more than 50% of their income towards rent. And all of those data sets together give us a picture about what's happening in this country. And what we can say is that homelessness has increased. In 2024, homelessness increased nationwide. And it did the same in 2023. And it is largely because we have an affordable housing crisis in this country.
You mentioned about HUD. This is a requirement under HUD to do this PIT count. What effect will the current administration's cuts to HUD's housing programs have on such programs such as the Housing First program?
So first, I want to have a point of clarification. There is no Housing First program proper. There is the Continuum of Care program, which is, I think, what you're talking about. The Continuum of Care program is the largest homelessness-specific program that we have in this country. It funds projects to serve people experiencing homelessness in about 380 continuums of care, and it funds close to 7,000 individual projects per year. So that program right now, I can't talk a lot about it. We have some active litigation happening with the Department of Housing and Urban Development. But what I can say is that what they have proposed through the notices of funding opportunity that have been put out by the administration in November and December, the proposal by the administration is to cut permanent housing, that is housing that is affordable to people at the lowest incomes and that has services that people want and need in order to access that housing and maintain it over time. It cuts the national amount of money that is available for those programs from about 87% of the total program to about 30%. Of the total program. And by my count, that means about 170,000 people nationwide will lose their permanent housing. And that program, just for a sense of scale for listeners, runs at about between $3.5 and $4 billion per year these days.
Sounds like a very big chunk to me, and a lot of people are going to be affected. Are you aware of any other federal funding sources that are on the horizon to be cut that will affect people and the potential to throw them into homelessness?
Sure. I think when we talk about homelessness, we can't actually talk about it sort of in a silo or in a vacuum. people experiencing homelessness are the same as people who are not experiencing homelessness might be experiencing housing instability. As I mentioned before, might be one paycheck or an emergency away from losing their housing. And so I think it's really important to think about the cuts that are being made by this administration to the safety net programs, because they will impact the number of people who are experiencing homelessness in addition to the impacts of the changes to the homelessness funding itself. And here's what I mean by that. What I mean is that when you cut Medicaid, for example, that provides medical care and services for people who are low income, or Medicare for people who are older. What that does is it puts more of the cost burden on people who actually can't afford it without those types of supports. So as we are seeing more families pay more of their income, not just towards rent, but towards their health insurance, for example, that took effect at the beginning of January, the cushion that they have between maintaining their housing and not becomes thinner and thinner. And the same can be said about SNAP benefits. That's food benefits for families and individuals across this country who rely on those benefits to help them, again, maintain some sort of a cushion between maybe paying a lot of their income towards rent, so they're able to both feed their family and pay rent. And as that cushion gets thinner and thinner, the number of people who are experiencing housing instability and potentially homelessness starts to increase. So we are tracking these kinds of changes in the social safety net quite closely at the Alliance, because we do think it is going to have an impact, and it will be compounded by the changes that the administration is making to homeless programs proper.
Well, I know you've only been at the Alliance for 3 years, but you've been aware of these issues for a long time. Have you, in your knowledge of history, has there been such an overt attempt to curtail services and things that could benefit people and potentially throw people into homelessness prior to this administration?
So the McKinney-Vento Act was passed in 1987. That was the federal government's sort of first real attempt to address what we would call modern homelessness, what we're seeing today, that really came up in the 60s, 70s, and the beginning of the 80s, right? So since that time, I think there's lots of things to be said about what happened in history before that. But what I'd like to focus on is since 1987, what we've seen. I do think that there are some parallels here with what happened during the Reagan administration and then again what happened during welfare reform. But for everything to be sort of cut at the same time, while homeless services are also being changed so significantly, no, I haven't seen that type of sort of backwards regression, for lack of a better term, certainly in my career, but I think even in the history of modern homelessness.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Ann Oliva. She's the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. And you're listening to us on A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org.
No home in this world anymore. My brother. brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door.
Okay, that's Woody Guthrie singing, I Ain't Got No Home in This World Anymore. And that was released in 1940 from his album, Dust Bowl Ballads. And today on A Better World, we are talking to Ann Oliva. She's the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, a public education, advocacy, and capacity-building organization dedicated to ending homelessness in the United States. Ann, I saw on your website that marginalized communities are increasingly impacted by homelessness. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and it is a question that I think a lot of people don't ask and is more relevant than ever right now in this political environment. And when we say marginalized communities, what we're talking about are Black, Indigenous, people of color. We're talking about gay and trans people, seniors, and others who are impacted by policies, structural policies that make it harder for them to access wealth and resources, and who are often discriminated against in their day-to-day lives. And these populations are overrepresented in the homeless population. What I mean by that is that their representation in the U.S. population as a whole is low, but their representation in the homeless population is higher or overrepresented. And that's because they've been historically marginalized, historically discriminated against, and not had access to the same kinds of resources that that others have access to. So, for example, when we talk about Black people who are experiencing homelessness, we know that Black people have been subject to discrimination in the housing market, for example, and many other areas of American life. But in the housing market, you can go back to redlining and restrictive covenants that didn't allow Black people to build the same kind of wealth that that their white counterparts could across the country. And that set of policies has reverberated for Black people up until today. And it shows up in the number of people who are extremely low income. It shows up in the number of people who are experiencing homelessness as well. And the same can be said for people who identify as LGBTQ. They are discriminated against in housing across the country and discriminated against in jobs. It is harder for folks to get jobs. And LGBTQ young people often leave home early because they are not accepted by their families and need to figure out how to survive in the United States. And they experience homelessness, therefore, at a higher rate than straight cisgender people. So I think it's really important to think about who, not just how we end homelessness, but who is experiencing homelessness and how we make up for the marginalization that people have experienced in their history and in their own lifetimes, in their own experiences. And in part, we do that by partnering with people who have lived experience of homelessness, not just as staff members or board members, but as advisors and members of the National Alliance to End Homelessness, to help advise us on how we can shape future policy to address the needs that they had coming into their homelessness experience.
I would imagine that's very impactful input to have from folks that have actually walked a mile in people's shoes to have that experience.
It's the most impactful information and partnership that we can possibly have, in my opinion. And working with people who have lived experience of homelessness or housing instability and these systems that have marginalized them or not served them is something that has changed the way I think about our work personally. I know that a number of years ago, towards the end of my tenure at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, we began a program called the Youth Homelessness Demonstration Program. And that program was funded by Congress to specifically address issues that young people come with when they're experiencing homelessness or housing instability and to end homelessness for young people. And we started meeting with young people who were either actively homeless or had experienced homelessness in their young lives. And what they were really clear about to us as the government was nothing about us without us. And the way that they approached that work changed the way that I approach the work, like foundationally. And I will be forever grateful to those young people who were willing to work with us early on, because it changed the way that we think about partnering. And it's not about tokenizing people or having one person on your board or one person on your staff that's supposed to represent all homeless people. It's about figuring out ways to have real partnerships with folks who have been marginalized, who have trauma related to homelessness, but who have expertise about how the system works or doesn't work for people who are in their shoes. I think it's some of the most important work I've done personally in my life.
That's such an important idea, I think. And I know a lot of nonprofits that do service work in the community integrate people who have actually experienced what that particular nonprofit is trying to address. I think I'm glad you brought that up. It's a very important point, I think. So when you talk about marginalized communities, do you include in that people who are living with mental illness?
Yeah, people with disabilities is people who have disabilities, some of whom might have mental health conditions, some of whom have substance use disorder, some of whom have physical or other developmental disabilities. People with disabilities is a large part of the marginalized populations that I was referencing earlier, because they've been discriminated against in jobs, in housing, and in many other ways.
And then the number of for mental health in terms of the number of services available for people gets cut as well. So it's I don't know quite how to go about trying to even start to address that. I mean, do people that have mental health issues, do they become homeless, or did they develop the mental health issues after they are homeless and they turn to substance use? It's how do we even sort out those different issues for people to begin helping them?
It's a good question, and I think it's often misunderstood by the general public about how homelessness and mental health conditions or substance use disorder intersect. Certainly, for some people, a mental health condition or a substance use disorder or both created conditions in their lives such that they ended up losing their housing, whether that housing was with a family member or was rental housing or housing that they owned. That certainly is the case for some folks. But for many people, maybe they had housing and they lost their housing, and just living on the streets, which is traumatic. I don't know how many people who are listening to this discussion today know somebody who's lived on the streets or has lived on the streets themselves, but just having to be outside in the elements, having to just figure out how to survive day to day is traumatic and can create for somebody conditions where they develop a mental health condition, or they develop a substance use disorder, or they use just to survive the streets every day. So I think it is a misconception out in the general public that mental health conditions or substance use is an underlying cause of homelessness. Everybody has their own story on how they, if you talk to people who are experiencing homelessness, everybody has an individual story about what happened in their lives to get them into the position of experiencing homelessness. But what's common among all of them is that they can't afford housing. Many, many more people in this country who suffer from substance use disorder or mental health conditions are housed. They have networks and the ability to access care in a way that people experiencing homelessness don't. And people who are unsheltered, when they are in that sort of physical traumatic situation and they are just trying to survive day to day, mental health conditions or substance use can get exacerbated on the street. And once they get into housing and they're able to shift their thinking from survival to figuring out how to live their lives, those conditions can more easily be addressed in the way that they want to address them. So thank you for asking that question, because I think it's a point of misconception for a lot of people.
You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And our guest today is Ann Oliva. She's with the National Alliance to End Homelessness. And we'll return with Ann in just a few minutes after this break.
Have a dollar. In fact, no, brother man, here, have two. $2 means a snack for me, but it means a big deal to you. Be strong, serve God only. Know that if you do, beautiful heaven awaits. Esther pulled my rope for the first time. I saw a man with no clothes, no money, no plate, Mr. Wendell. That's his name. No one ever knew his name, cause he's a no one. Never thought twice about spending on an old bum until I had the chance to really get to know one. Now that I know him, to give him money isn't charity. He gives me some knowledge, I buy him some shoes. And to think blacks spend all their money on big colleges, still most of y'all come out confused. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell. Mr. Wendell has freedom, a free that you and I think is dumb. Free to be without the worries of a quick to diss society, for Mr. Wendell's a bum. His only worries are sickness and an occasional harassment by the police in their chase. Uncivilized, we call him, but I just saw him eat off the food we waste. Civilization, are we really civilized? Yes or no? Who are we to judge when thousands of innocent men could be brutally assaulted?
Okay, welcome back. That's Arrested Development singing Mr. Wendell, from their album 3 years, 5 months, and 2 days in the life of Arrested Development. And today our guest on A Better World is Ann Oliva. She's the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Ann, what motivates you to do this work?
I get asked that question a lot. I've just, as context, you know, I've been doing this work for more than 30 years. I started as a VISTA volunteer in a transitional housing program for women with kids who were experiencing homelessness in New Mexico. And I've done this in various ways, whether it was through direct service or local work here in the District of Columbia, national work. I worked on disaster recovery after Hurricane Katrina. And what motivates me every day is that this is a solvable problem. And I talk to people experiencing homelessness all the time. I talk to providers all the time. And it is my fundamental belief that we should be treating all of our neighbors with compassion and respect, and providing, we shouldn't be making people have to prove that they deserve housing. I think everybody in this country deserves housing and deserves the chance to live their lives in the ways that will make them happy. And ending homelessness is a way to ensure that. From a personal standpoint, I'm the daughter of immigrants. My parents came here with almost nothing and made a life here, and they got help along the way, especially early on when they first came to this country from Cuba. And I think that that experience of getting help to help my family thrive in this country created a bunch of kids, me and my siblings, who are all do-gooders in some way, shape, or form. And this is my form of do-gooding.
Well, thank you for your do-gooding. And I'm sure the homeless folks and those who work with them are grateful as well. So are there times when you become discouraged or get down about your work?
Of course, there are times where I get discouraged. I wouldn't be a human if I didn't get discouraged. Right now, my organization is pursuing litigation against the federal agency that I used to work for. That is not the place where I thought I would be at this point in my career, or in the trajectory of helping people experiencing homelessness. There are certainly times when I talk to people who are frontline service providers and they talk to me about the burnout that they're experiencing, or I talk to people on the street and they feel invisible to passersby or the system that's supposed to serve them. And those are all discouraging. But at the same time, when I talk to people who are serving people experiencing homelessness and doing the hard work every day, and they're just getting up and they're doing it in spite of headwinds and the kinds of headwinds that we're seeing right now from the Trump administration, I mean, that's harder than what I'm doing. And surviving on the street is harder than what I'm doing. And I just have a lot of I have a lot of respect for others in my field who are doing this work either alongside me or in their communities day in and day out, and they just keep showing up. And so I'm going to keep showing up too. And, you know, one of the things that I think is really important to the Alliance as an organization, and given our sort of position in the field as leaders, is that we show up, especially at our national conferences, and we bring joy, because it is really important for people who are doing this hard work and people who are experiencing homelessness or who have experienced homelessness who come to our conferences to not just learn about what's working to end homelessness, but to have a moment to lean into joy in a way that they might not get in their day-to-day work. And that's something that we sort of hold tight onto at the Alliance, is that we do the hard work, but we also help people see the joy in it.
And I certainly don't want to dwell on the negative, but when you talk about headwinds, I have to ask you about this. There's a page on your website that talks about the Supreme Court decision from 2024 about, I think the case was the city of Grants Pass, Oregon versus Johnson.
Correct.
And when I learned about that, and then I read more about it on your website, I found myself being quite discouraged. And then I found out about a law in North Carolina that's been, hasn't been passed yet, but, and this is happening in communities around the country. Could you kind of briefly give us the scenario of what this Supreme Court decision was about?
Yes. The Supreme Court took up a case, as you mentioned, the city of Grants Pass, Oregon versus Gloria Johnson. Gloria Johnson was a woman experiencing homelessness in the small city of Grants Pass. And Grants Pass basically was in the position of criminalizing or fining, ticketing, or arresting people experiencing homelessness for sleeping or looking like they were sleeping or resting in public spaces. And it made its way to through the Ninth Circuit courts and into the Supreme Court. And at the end of the day, the Supreme Court ruled that it's not cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to punish people for experiencing homelessness, even when there's not enough shelter available in a community to accommodate them. And that ruling sort of unleashed a number of laws or ordinances, state laws or local ordinances across the country that criminalize, again, that's like fining, ticketing, or arresting people simply for not having a place to live in their community. Again, even if there are not enough shelter beds to accommodate people who are experiencing homelessness in that community. And most communities don't have enough shelter beds to accommodate everybody who is experiencing homelessness. And then by way of context, I just want to make sure that folks understand the numbers that we're talking about here. So every week, according to HUD's own data, every week in this country, on average, about 19,000 people become homeless for the first time. Every week. Communities and homeless services systems cannot keep up with that level of inflow. And that is why we are seeing the rise in unsheltered homelessness that I mentioned early in our conversation. Beginning at around 2016, we started to see these numbers of unsheltered people increasing nationwide. So the system itself, because of the housing market, more people are coming into homelessness and less people are able to exit homelessness because there are not enough available and affordable units for them to go into from their homelessness experience. So as folks get sort of stuck in the system, the number of people in unsheltered locations increases. And instead of, unfortunately, instead of using evidence-based practices and leaning into providing resources for folks, a lot of communities have, after the Supreme Court decision, taken sort of a political approach rather than a policy approach, which is to ban camping, to fine or ticket, arrest people for things like encroachment on sidewalks, which is important. We shouldn't be blocking sidewalks, but the answer shouldn't be to fine people with a ticket that we know they can't pay, because if they could pay it, they would be in a hotel for the night, or they would be in an apartment.
I found this website. I don't know if it's through your site or not, but it's called Housing Not Handcuffs. Mm-hmm. And one of the maps on that website looks at the number of bills that have been introduced to curtail homelessness through punitive measures. And I was surprised, because I don't want to pick on Oregon necessarily, but it's a state I usually think of as being very progressive, but they had more bills introduced than any other state.
Yeah, it's that website is operated by one of our partner national organizations. That's the National Homelessness Law Center that runs that site. We track it alongside them, you know, that data. And it is shocking, I think, that so many communities have decided that fining, ticketing, and arresting people is the way to address homelessness for their neighbors, rather than providing the resources that are needed to actually end homelessness in their community. There's a ton of research on this issue. The research really shows that these types of measures do not end homelessness in a community. They largely just push people from downtown areas or places where these ordinances are enforced, to more remote areas, to the woods, to national parks, or to other parts of the community that are not, that don't have the infrastructure to serve people experiencing homelessness.
That's Ann Oliva. She's the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. And she's our guest today on A Better World, and we are talking about the state of homelessness in the United States. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM, Asheville, North Carolina.
Sing. Homeless, homeless, moonlight still you wanna make night lake. Homeless, homeless, moonlight still you wanna make night lake. Homeless,
we are
homeless, the moonlight still you wanna make night lake.
We are
homeless,
homeless,
homeless.
Okay, that song is Ladysmith Black Mambazo, and the song is Homeless. And our guest today is Ann Oliva, CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Ann, you mentioned early in the interview that you think an end to homelessness is possible. Are you aware of the, say, the public sentiment of, or the public's will to address homelessness and end it once and for all? And is the looking at state legislative action the way to gauge it?
So I wouldn't be the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness if I did not believe that ending homelessness is possible. I think we have seen what's possible a number of times, but I'll pinpoint one in particular that a lot of people maybe have heard about, and that is the progress being made on veterans homelessness. Veterans homelessness has been cut by more than half since 2010. And that is because of three things, three primary factors in the way that we address homelessness for veterans have allowed us to cut the number of veterans experiencing homelessness in this country by more than half. First is that the resources that are provided by Congress, that are appropriated by Congress, are much closer to the scale of need than what we have for any other population of people experiencing homelessness. So Congress is year over year appropriating funding to assist veterans who have served our country and who are experiencing homelessness right now to get them out of homelessness, one. Two, the policy and program design, including Housing First, has been a big part of how those programs that are appropriated funding by Congress operate. The policy is solid, program design is evidence-based, and those have been implemented nationwide. So funding at scale, evidence-based policy and program design. And then the third one is political will. There is a lot of political will and leadership around ending homelessness for veterans. And that means everybody from local mayors to city council members to leadership in the administration, whatever administration, have prioritized ending homelessness among veterans. When you have those three things together, we can make really strong progress. But we don't have those three things for any other population of people experiencing homelessness. So I say all of that to maybe circle back to your question about what does the population think? What do people think about ending homelessness? And certainly when we do our opinion polling, and when many others do their opinion polling, what we hear from the public is that they don't want punitive measures. They actually largely understand that ticketing a person who has no money isn't going to end their homelessness. They understand that. And what they want is solutions. But what they also want is people off their streets. And I think that that's where this sort of political response to unsheltered homelessness, to very visible homelessness, comes into play. And organizations that don't have expertise in homelessness, haven't served people experiencing homelessness, can push those sorts of punitive policies at the state level in order to create this sort of environment of criminalization, when in fact we know that that doesn't actually work.
So we're in the last quarter of the hour, but I wanted to have you touch on a bit more, if you could, a little more detail about the vision of the National Alliance to End Homelessness.
So the vision of the National Alliance to end Homelessness is pretty simple. We want to live in a nation where homelessness as we know it today doesn't exist. That means that affordable housing is in reach for folks at all income levels. It means that people have the services and supports they need in order to stay in their housing. We know that it's better for people and it's cheaper on our systems to maintain, to help people maintain their housing rather than lose it and have to get rehoused again. We want to make sure that folks are treated equitably and with respect in all of our systems across the U.S. social safety net. And all of those things together can actually happen. We have the capacity to make it happen in this country. Maybe not right this minute in this political environment, but I think based on our polling, it's what other people who are regular citizens want as well. They want the citizens of this nation to be treated with dignity and respect and to be taken care of.
I want to refer the listeners to your website because there's a lot of information about all the varied activities that the Alliance is involved in. Let me ask you about this conference, the Leadership Conference on Ending Homelessness. Can you talk about what happens at those conferences and who attends?
So the Leadership Summit on Ending Homelessness is new for us, but the Alliance does run two conferences a year, usually one in the early spring and another, which is on the West Coast, and then another in July here in Washington, D.C. And the purpose of those conferences is to convene the field. As many people as we can fit, we usually go in the July conference, which tends to be bigger. We're about 2,300 people at that conference. And it's to convene the field. It's the way that we get to have direct conversations with our members and with people who are doing this work on the front lines, who have experienced homelessness themselves, with state and local decision makers who are addressing these issues from a government perspective, and bringing them all together and having really critical conversations about what's happening in the field so that we can learn from them and so that we can also make sure that they have the information from other communities that are doing things well or struggling with certain things. The Leadership Conference for this year is a little bit different because we are focusing specifically on developing leadership skills, and we think that that's something that's really timely for, it's what we've heard from our members over the last year, is that leading in this particular moment in our nation's history, leading through what can be a really, really tough political, local environment, what can be really difficult decisions that local leaders are having to make, that folks needed some support, not just skill building, but also an opportunity to talk to their colleagues and peers about how they're handling these same situations.
So just a couple of ending questions. Let me ask you, why do you think those of us who aren't homeless should care about people who are homeless?
It's a great question, and it's one that I don't get that often, but I love to answer. And that is, I think most of us know that when everybody in our community is housed and can afford their housing, the community is better for it. It's not just better for it because we don't have people who are living outside. It's better for it because people who are experiencing homelessness, just like everybody else, have talents and expertise and things that they bring to the table that are not available to a community when all they're trying to do is survive from day to day. I have met people who were experiencing homelessness who are incredibly talented artists and poets and writers, and who have started businesses and contribute in real huge ways to their community. And it's sad when we don't have those contributions available to us because they can't afford a place to live. So I think we should all care about it, because our community could be stronger. Our community could be better if everybody had a safe and affordable place to lay their heads at night.
So do you have any recommendations about what the everyday person like myself can do to help address homelessness?
So the first thing I would say is vote for elected officials who support affordable housing. That is the number one thing that everyday people should be doing and thinking about and asking people who are running for office at the local level about. We need elected officials who support safe and affordable housing for everyone. And then beyond that, I feel pretty strongly that for most everyday citizens, the way that they can contribute is to reach out to a local nonprofit organization that's serving people who are experiencing homelessness, whether it's through meals, whether it's through emergency shelter, whether it's through permanent housing, and see what kinds of things they need, whether it's material things like toothpaste or deodorant or other essentials that people who are experiencing homelessness often don't have access to, or it's expertise that you could bring to their organization to help them with their accounting or to help them support people who are experiencing homelessness, or to just volunteer. But this is local work. I'm a national organization and we do a lot of great things at the national level, but where the rubber meets the road is at the local level, and supporting local organizations that use evidence-based practices to serve people with compassion and respect is maybe the number two things that everyday citizens can do in addition to voting for affordable housing.
So how can people find out more about the Alliance?
You can go to our website at endhomelessness.org. There's a lot of information on there, and we can help get folks connected to their local continuum of care that manages homeless services in their region.
Any final thoughts you'd like to share?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me and for spending this much time talking about an issue that is very clearly close to my heart, but that we all, as citizens and residents of this country, need to be thinking about. And I just would encourage folks to get involved at the local level. Your local nonprofits who are doing this work need support more than ever.
Okay, I want to thank Ann Oliva. She's the CEO of the National Alliance to End Homelessness. Ann, thank you so much for coming on the show, and thank you for the work you do, and thanks to all the people at the Alliance. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Tom Waits singing On the Nickel from his album Heart Attack and Vine.
Sticks and stones will break my bones. It always will be true. And when your mom was dead and gone, I'll sing this lullaby just for you. So what becomes of all the little boys who never comb their hair? war.